Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1181. Terror, the Afghanistan War, and the American Deep State, Part 1. This is being recorded on April 15th of the year 2021. Before I get into the main body of the broadcast, I would like to remind you of two things. First of all, please do avail yourselves of the 32 gigabyte flash drive that is available. It has all of my life's work, some 41 years plus, through For the Record 1156, and a mini library of old anti-fascist books as well. There is a link at the top of each post for programs or food for thought, and you can click on that link to get that flash drive, and I get no money whatsoever from that or from the broadcasts or the website or anything else. Anything else connected with this effort, I should say. Also, sister station WFMU-FM is podcasting the For the Record program. So if that is the best way for you to consume the material, there again is a link at the top of each post on the SpitfireList.com website for you to obtain the WFMU podcast. Now, yesterday, actually I guess it was day before yesterday, President Biden announced that the last 2,500 troops would be back from Afghanistan by the 20th anniversary of the September 11th attacks, which were the precipitating element for the invasion, well, not the invasion, but the war in Afghanistan. Really, we should say the second war, or perhaps even the third. The first, of course, was when a covert operation begun under Zbigniew Brzezinski on the Carter Watch deliberately lured the Soviets into Afghanistan. Then there might be said to be a second Afghan war, which was a civil war following the withdrawal of the Soviet troops. And then finally again in 2001, following the September 11th attacks, the U.S. began its involvement there along with some NATO countries, and that has continued with a dismal rate of success to date. In these broadcasts, and there will be certainly two of them, perhaps three, we're going to look at the overlapping considerations of terror and terrorism and the Afghanistan War, which again followed the September 11th attacks, and the American Deep State. That is a term, well, really it predates the publication of the book, but for our purposes here, we are going to be talking about the American Deep State as set forth by the brilliant Berkeley professor Peter Dale Scott, a name familiar to long-time listeners, and the author of an unpublished manuscript that we looked at in For the Record programs 1149, 1150, and 1169. Also, the author of an article from Covert Action Quarterly from their winter of 1986 called How Alan Dulles and the SS Preserved Each Other. For the bulk of the material in this series, whether it's two or three programs, we are going to be relying on the 2015 book by Peter Dale Scott titled The American Deep State, subtitled Wall Street, Big Oil, and the Attack on U.S. Democracy. That was published in hardcover by Roman and Littlefield and copyrighted 2015 by Peter Dale Scott. Before we get into what might be called something of a preamble to discussion of the deep states, talking about cartels, talking about the agenda of big oil, both U.S. and British in Iran, prior to and during the 1953 CIA-engineered coup against Mossadegh. I'd like to look at two items that we will repeat later on in these programs in a larger context. But as the troops prepare, as Johnny comes marching home, or prepares to, so to speak, looking at the machinations of the deep state and the consummate cynicism that perhaps as much as anything else and resulting from the mercenary considerations of the deep state, again subtitled by Peter Dale Scott, Wall Street and Big Oil. Looking at an incident that actually took place on the battlefield in Afghanistan shortly after U.S. troops entered that country in 2001. Reading now from Peter Dale Scott's The American Deep State, Wall Street, Big Oil, and the Attack on U.S. Democracy, we find just how subordinated official policy could become to deep state needs was demonstrated in November of 2001 when Dick Cheney, obviously vice president at the time, at the request of Pakistani President Musharraf and the ISI, that parenthetically is Pakistani intelligence, approved secret airlifts to ferry surrounded Pakistani and high-level al-Qaeda fighters out of Afghanistan to safety in Pakistan. Quote, Cheney took charge. The approval was not shared with anyone at state, including Colin Powell, until well after the event. Clearly, the ISI was running its own war against the Americans. One more time. Just how subordinated official policy could become to deep state needs was demonstrated in November of 2001 when Vice President Dick Cheney, at the request of Pakistani President Musharraf and the ISI, approved secret airlifts to ferry surrounded Pakistani and high-level al-Qaeda fighters out of Afghanistan to safety in Pakistan. Quote, Cheney took charge. The approval was not shared with anyone at state, including Colin Powell, until well after the event. Clearly, the ISI was running its own war against the Americans. Well, call me old-fashioned, but in once upon a time, long ago, when I was young, that would have been called treason. Obviously, that is what it is. And perhaps as much as anything, the cynicism I alluded to is not only commonplace, or is commonplace in the narrative that we are going to be presenting, but it is perhaps the central element of what we're looking at. And again, that and what I'm about to read will be re-presented in a longer context later on, either in this program or probably in our next broadcast. We're going to be looking at the high-level protection of various al-Qaeda operatives, including an Egyptian national named Ali Mohammed, who trained with the Green Beret and was involved with using al-Qaeda combatants not only in Afghanistan, but in Bosnia as well, and other places, either in the former communist countries or actually in parts of the former Soviet Union. We're also going to be looking at protection of Jamal Khalifa, of people involved with the assassination of right-wing Rabbi Meir Kahane, the founder of the Jewish Defense League. That was said to be the work of a lone jihadi. As we will see later, that was actually the official protection of the Al-Kifa organization, the Al-Kifa Mosque in Brooklyn, because that was part of a larger jihadist / Al-Qaeda network. Al-Qaeda actually became named as such after the Soviets left and as the wars there began to transform. But not only Ali Mohammed, but initially Ramzi Youssef, his uncle, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who is currently involved in legal proceedings, he was said to be the mastermind of the September 11th attacks. And we will fill all of this in as we look at really the political norm as applies to deep state and U.S. intelligence treatment of key Al-Qaeda operatives. Basically, they were deliberately shielded. And what we're looking at, like Dick Cheney arranging for Pakistani and high-level Al-Qaeda combatants who were surrounded by U.S. troops to be airlifted out of Afghanistan, what we're looking at here is treason. And this concerns the prosecution, and it was a very limited prosecution indeed, of the plotters in the first World Trade Center attack. That was a 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center, and the mastermind was Ramzi Youssef, an Al-Qaeda operative who spent a lot of time in the Philippines, and was someone who was plotting something called Operation Bojinka, which, interestingly enough, is Croatian for Big Bang, in which a number of airliners were going to be blown up more or less simultaneously. However, the shielding not only of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, but of information on Ramzi Youssef's laptop, which contained the full details of the plot that was to be executed on September 11th, 2001. And this is in the trial of Ramzi Youssef and company in connection with the first World Trade Center attack, the bombing in 1993. Professor Scott writes, in Triple Cross, Peter Lance, who does not mention Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's escape from Copper, focuses instead on the way that later in the same year, U.S. federal prosecutors kept Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's name out of the trial of Ramzi Youssef in connection with the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. One more time. In Triple Cross, Peter Lance, who does not mention Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's escape from Qatar, which I believe was in 1996, focuses instead on the way that later in that same year, U.S. federal prosecutors kept Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's name out of the trial of Ramzi Youssef in connection with the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. Quote from Triple Cross by Peter Lance. Assistant U.S. attorneys Mike Garcia and Dietrich Snell, capital S-N-E-L-L, presented a riveting evidence-driven case and characterized the material retrieved from Ramzi Youssef's Toshiba laptop as, quote, the most devastating evidence of all, unquote. While Youssef's Toshiba laptop contained the full details of the plot later executed on September 11th, not a word of that scenario was mentioned during trial. Most surprising, during the entire summer-long trial, the name of the fourth Bojinka conspirator, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, was mentioned by name only once in reference to a letter found in Ramzi Youssef's apartment. One more time, because this, again, as we will see, this is more or less business as usual, or was. And again, call me old-fashioned, I'm an old guy. This, once upon a time, this would have been considered treason. And this in the trial of Ramzi Youssef. Assistant U.S. Attorneys Mike Garcia and Dietrich Snell presented a riveting evidence-driven case and characterized the material retrieved from Ramzi's Toshiba laptop as, quote, the most devastating evidence of all, unquote. While Youssef's Toshiba laptop contained the full details of the plot later executed on September 11th, not a word of that scenario was mentioned during trial. Most surprising, during the entire summer-long trial, the name of the fourth Bojinka conspirator, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, was mentioned by name only once in reference to a letter found in Ramzi Youssef's apartment. And again, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed now in the long, tortuous legal process, the said mastermind of the September 11th attacks. And although the information on that plot was on Ramzi Youssef's Toshiba laptop and in the possession of U.S. prosecutors, it was not brought out in trial, and this was years before the September 11th attacks. We will present both that and the evacuation of the Al-Qaeda and Pakistani combatants from encirclement by U.S. troops in Afghanistan in November of 2001 in a larger context. However, by way of looking at one of the considerations that it really is fundamental to the presentation of the programs I've done over the decades and was most recently treated in, for the record, 1180, and that is the consideration of cartels. Cartels are international monopolies, and as I said in our last program, and as I have noted many times over the decades, by the period between the world wars, cartels had basically eclipsed the nation state as the principal operational entities in world power politics, and they are one of the fundamental elements of what Peter Dale Scott calls the deep state. We are going to take a look now at the petroleum cartel, primarily U.S., but also British oil companies, specifically the Anglo-Persian Oil Company, later called BP, or British Petroleum, now BP. And we're going to look at how the 1953 CIA coup against Mossadegh in Iran, I was about to say Afghanistan, really was not only a furtherance of policy that had been set by the petroleum cartel, but really they were already basically executing the fundamentals of that machination before the 1953 coup. As we get into this, there is good discussion by Peter Dale Scott of a quote that John Foster Dulles, who along with his Nazi-sympathizing brother, Alan Dulles, were principal attorneys for the consummately important Sullivan and Cromwell law firm. And Dulles pretty much, John Foster Dulles, pretty much laid out the dominance of the cartels, or their top Rome significance as opposed to the nation state, in a discussion, in a letter to a British colleague, Peter Dale Scott writes as follows, in the American beat state, Wall Street, big oil, and the attack on U.S. democracy, the international lawyers of Wall Street did not hide from each other their shared belief that they understood better than Washington the requirements for running the world. As John Foster Dulles wrote in the 1930s to a British colleague, quote, the word cartel has here, meaning in the U.S., assumed the stigma of a boogeyman which the politicians are constantly attacking. The fact of the matter is that most of these politicians are highly insular and nationalistic, and because the political organization of the world has under such influence been so backward, business people who have had to cope realistically with international problems have had to find ways for getting through and around stupid political barriers. And that could be said to be not only the foundation of what we were looking at with the evacuation of the troops in Afghanistan in November of 2001, but also the shielding of terrorists and their operations, which we're about to look at. And in many discussions, we have used the very important book, The Old Boys, subtitled The American Elite and the Origins of the CIA by Burton Hirsch. We looked at that in, among other programs, for the record, 1009. And it is really that old boy network and the manifestation of same in the operations of CIA that we're looking at here. And as Peter Dale Scott notes, I'm talking about Alan Dulles, John Foster Dulles' brother and fellow attorney at Sullivan and Cromwell. After reading that quote that I just read, he says, this same mentality also explains why Alan Dulles, as an Office of Strategic Services or OSS officer in 1945, simply evaded orders from Washington forbidding him to negotiate with SS General Karl Wolff about a conditional surrender of German forces in Italy, an important breach of Roosevelt's agreement with Stalin at Yalta for unconditional surrender, a breach that is regarded by many as helping lead to the Cold War. And it explains why Alan Dulles, as CIA director in 1957, dealt summarily with Eisenhower's reluctance to authorize more than occasional U-2 overflights over the USSR by secretly approving a plan with Britain's MI6, that's British Overseas Intelligence, whereby U-2 flights could be authorized instead by the UK Prime Minister Macmillan. A remarkable turn of events, once again. And it explains why Alan Dulles, as CIA director in 1957, dealt summarily with Eisenhower's reluctance to authorize more than occasional U-2 overflights with the USSR by secretly approving a plan with Britain's MI6, whereby U-2 flights could be authorized instead by the UK Prime Minister Macmillan. This mentality exhibited itself in 1952 when Harry Truman's Justice Department sought to break up the cartel agreements whereby Standard Oil of New Jersey, now Exxon, and four other oil majors controlled global oil distribution. The other four were Standard Oil Company of New York, or SOCOMI, later Mobil, Standard Oil of California, now Chevron, Gulf Oil, and Texaco. together with Royal Dutch Shell and Anglo-Iranian, later BP, they comprised the so-called Seven Sisters of the Cartel. Faced with a government order to hand over relevant documents, Exxon's lawyer Arthur Dean at Sullivan and Cromwell, where Foster was a senior partner, refused. Quote, "If it were not for the question of national security, we would be perfectly willing to face either a criminal or a civil suit. But this is the kind of information the Kremlin would love to get its hands on." At this time, the oil cartel was working closely with the British Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, AIOC, later BP, to prevent AIOC's nationalization by Iran's Premier Mossadegh by instituting in May of 1951 a successful boycott of Iranian oil exports. Quote, "In May of 1951, the AIOC secured the backing of the other oil majors who had every interest in discouraging nationalization. None of the large companies would touch Iranian oil despite one or two picturesque episodes the boycott held. As a result, Iranian oil production fell from 241 million barrels in 1950, again, 241 million barrels in 1950, to just 10.6 million barrels in 1952. Quote, "This was accomplished by denying Iran the ability to export its crude oil. At that time, the Seven Sisters controlled almost 99% of the crude oil tankers in the world for such export, and even more importantly, the markets to which it was going," unquote. But Truman declined, despite a direct personal appeal from Winston Churchill to have the CIA participate in efforts to overthrow Mossadegh, and instead dispatched Avril Harriman to Tehran in a failed effort to negotiate a peaceful resolution of Mossadegh's differences with London. All this changed with the election of Eisenhower in November of 1952, with considerable support from the oil industry, followed by the appointment of the Dulles brothers to be Secretary of State, that was John Foster, and head of CIA, that was Allen Dulles. The Justice Department's criminal complaint against the oil cartel was swiftly replaced by a civil suit from which the oil cartel eventually emerged unscathed. Eisenhower, an open friend of the oil industry, changed the charges from criminal to civil and transferred responsibility of the case from the Department of Justice to the Department of State, the first time in history that an antitrust case was handed to state for prosecution. Seeing as how the Secretary of State was John Foster Dulles and the defense counsel for the oil cartel was Dulles' former law firm, Sullivan and Cromwell, the case was as good as dead. Thereafter, cooperative control of the world market by the major oil companies remained in effect with varying degrees of success until the oil embargo of 1973-1974. That the cooperation was more than tacit can be seen by the fact that antitrust regulations were specifically set aside a number of times during the 1950 to 1973 period, allowing the major companies to negotiate as a group with various Mideastern countries, and after its inception in 1960 with the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, or OPEC. Also in November of 1952, CIA officials began planning to involve the CIA in the efforts of MI6 and the oil companies in Iran, although its notorious Operation PP Ajax to overthrow Mossadegh was not finally approved by Eisenhower until July 22nd of 1953. The events of 1953 strengthened the role of the oil cartel as a structural component of the American deep state, drawing on its powerful connections to both Wall Street and the CIA. Another such component was the Arabian American Oil Company, or Aramco, in Saudi Arabia, which increased oil production in 1951 to 1953 to offset the loss of oil from Iran. Until it was fully nationalized in 1980, Aramco maintained undercover CIA personnel like William Eby among its top advisors. The five American oil majors in particular were also strengthened by the success of Ajax, at the overthrow of Mossadegh, as Anglo-Iranian renamed BP was henceforth forced to share 40% of the oil from its Iran refinery with them. Nearly all recent accounts of Mossadegh's overthrow treat it as a covert intelligence operation, with the oil cartel, when mentioned at all, playing a subservient role. However, the chronology, and above all, the belated approval from Eisenhower, suggest that it was the CIA that came belatedly in 1953 to assist an earlier oil cartel operation rather than vice versa. In terms of the deep state in 1951, the oil cartel or deep state initiated a process that the American public state only authorized 2 years later. Yet the inevitable bias in academic or archival historiography, working only with those primary sources that are publicly available, is to think of the Mossadegh tragedy as simply a, quote, CIA coup, unquote. The oil cartel's victories in 1952 and 1953 left a legacy that was not felt only in Iran. As we shall see, the oil majors now have a license to act in conjunction with the CIA to destabilize or overthrow governments in other countries, such as Indonesia in 1965. Later in this chapter, we will see how oil companies, Saudi Arabia, and former CIA personnel all operated together in ways that terminated the presidential career of someone who had earned their disapproval, President Jimmy Carter. That, of course, the October surprise, and not only did they end Jimmy Carter's presidency, but as we have looked at in For the Record programs 8, 96, 97, 98, and 99, interviews with the heroic Farah Mansour, they actually installed the mullahs in Iran as an anti-communist bulwark on the southern flank of the Soviet Union. It also helped to destabilize Jimmy Carter when he refused to reappoint George H.W. Bush as CIA director. And indeed, the oil companies and the machinations between the U.S., Saudi Arabia, and Qatar and the UAE have a lot to do with, they basically are the corporate / economic foundation for the deep state relationships that, as we are about to see, help to actively shield terrorists from prosecution until they were able to execute some of the most destructive terrorist incidents that beset the U.S. in the late 90s and early part of this century, such as the 1993 World Trade Center attack, the 1998 bombings of U.S. embassies in Africa, and particularly the Nairobi, Kenya embassy, and of course the 2001 attacks which led to the invasion of, well, not the invasion, but the attack on Afghanistan, and the 20-year-long quagmire that followed that. Now, we're going to begin with Peter Bale Scott's discussion of a gentleman, well, a fellow named Ali Mohammed. He was an Egyptian national who received special forces training in the U.S. and was involved with training jihadis, sending them to Afghanistan and later to places like Bosnia and Chechnya. And apparently because of that, he was shielded, and the Al-Kifa Mosque and Center in Brooklyn, where the blind Sheikh, I've forgotten his name. We'll come to him. Sheikh Rahman was his name. The blind Sheikh held forth. There are several overlapping plots here. One of them is the assassination of Meir Kahane, the ultra-right-wing rabbi and head of the Jewish Defense League. That was ultimately attributed to the work of a lone jihadi. As we will see, people who later were involved both in the 1993 World Trade Center bombing and the embassy attacks in 1998, and ultimately the September 11th attacks were part of that milieu, and yet U.S. prosecutors deliberately attenuated that because these same terrorists were also involved with some of the proxy warrior operations, such as Afghanistan, Bosnia, Chechnya. Those forces are active in Syria today, where former Al-Qaeda forces have basically changed their name and are part of the, quote, freedom fighters, unquote, opposing the Assad regime in Syria. And they are also very much part of the Uyghur, basically rebellion and terrorist operation in Xinjiang province in China. In fact, the International Institute of Islamic Thought, one of the principal organizations, although Peter Bale Scott does not talk about it, it was one of the principal organizations that was raided on the March 20th, 2002 Operation Green Quest raids, and those were subsequently covered up by Robert Mueller's FBI. The IIIT figures prominently in the Uyghur jihadi support effort in Xinjiang province, where once again, elements that were better known as Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State, are now functioning as proxy warriors for not only the West, but Turkey as well. Now, when Ali Mohammed was arrested by the RCMP in Canada, he was eventually, I believe it was at the Montreal airport, he eventually was freed when an FBI agent named John Zent, capital Z-E-N-T, vouched for him, and the RCMP let him go. That is where we will begin here. Peter Bale Scott writes in a section called The Longer History of FBI and U.S. Protection for Ali Mohammed. Why did John Zemp vouch safe for Mohammed in 1993 so that the RCMP released him? The explanation of Peter Lance, the best chronicler of FBI culpability in both the First and Second World Trade Center attacks, is that Zemp did so because Mohammed was already working as his personal informant, quote, feeding Zent intelligence, unquote, on Mexican smugglers who were moving illegal immigrants into the United States from the South, unquote. FBI agent Clunan, capital C-L-O-O-N-A-N, confirms that Mohammed had been working as a local FBI informant since 1992. Elsewhere, Lance describes Zent as, quote, trusting and distracted, unquote, so that he failed to realize Mohammed's importance. But the FBI's protection of Ali Mohammed did not begin with Zent, nor was it limited to him. It dated back at least to 1989, according to the following Pentagon security bio account. Quote, while serving in the Army at Fort Bragg, he, Ali Mohammed, traveled on weekends to Jersey City, New Jersey, and to Connecticut to train other Islamic fundamentalists in surveillance, weapons, and explosives. Telephone records show that while at Fort Bragg and later Mohammed maintained a very close and active relationship with the Office of Services, or Maktab al-Khidmat, as we have seen. That was run by George H.W. Bush when he was vice president. Beginning again, telephone records show that while at Fort Bragg, and later, Mohammed maintained a very close and active relationship with the Office of Services, Maktab al-Khidmat, of the Afghan Mujahideen in Brooklyn, which at that time was recruiting volunteers and soliciting funds for the jihad against the Soviets in Afghanistan. This was the main recruitment center for the network that, after the Soviets left Afghanistan, became known as Al-Qaeda. The FBI observed and photographed Mohammed giving weapons training to a group of New York area residents during four successive weekends in July of 1989. They drove from the Farouk Mosque in Brooklyn to a shooting range in Calverton, Long Island, and they fired AK-47 rifles, semi-automatic handguns, and revolvers during what appeared to be training sessions. For reasons that are unknown, the FBI then ceased its surveillance of the group. Similarly, in 1993, an FBI supervisor would again abruptly close down surveillance of another group from the Al-Qaeda Center at a militant training camp in Pennsylvania. In the subsequent trial of Mohammed's trainees and others for bombing the World Trade Center, the defense attorney Roger Stavis, capital S-T-A-V-I-S, established that Mohammed was giving the Al-Qaeda trainees, quote, courses on how to make bombs, how to use guns, how to use Molotov cocktails, unquote. He showed the court that the training manual seized in Nocera's apartment, quote, showed how to make explosives and some kind of improvised weapons and explosives, unquote. Nocera, by the way, was the guy ultimately convicted of killing Meir Kahane. And again, he was portrayed in his trial as a lone jihadist, and he obviously was not. Continuing, Peter Dale Scott writes, so why would the FBI, after having discovered terrorist training, then cease its surveillance? Here, the Wall Street Journal gives the correct answer. The FBI ceased surveillance because they somehow determined that the men were training, quote, to help the Mujahideen fighting the Soviet puppet government in Afghanistan, unquote. Note, however, that the Mujahideen were no longer fighting the Soviet army itself, which had been withdrawn from Afghanistan as of March of 1989. In the next section, Al-Qaeda, Ali Mohammed, and the flow of Arabs to Afghanistan. Afghanistan is indeed a plausible explanation for the FBI's terminating its videotaping of Al-Qaedists from the Brooklyn Al-Qaeda Refugee Center. Incorporated officially in 1987 as Afghan Refugee Services Incorporated, the Al-Qaeda Center, quote, was the recruitment hub for U.S.-based Muslims seeking to fight the Soviets. As many as 200 fighters were funneled through the center to Afghanistan. More importantly, it was, quote, a branch of the Office of Services, or Maktab al-Khidmat, the Pakistan-based organization that Osama bin Laden helped finance and lead and would later become Al-Qaeda, one more time, of the Al-Qaeda Center. More importantly, it was, quote, a branch of the Office of Services, or Maktab al-Khidmat, the Pakistan-based organization that Osama bin Laden helped finance and lead and would later become Al-Qaeda. In fact, it was Mustafa Shalabi, S-H-A-L-A-B-I, an Egyptian who founded and ran the center, whom bin Laden called in 1991 when he needed help moving to Sudan. As we shall see, the Maktab, created in 1984 to organize Saudi financial support to the foreign Arab Afghans in the Jihad, was part of a project that had the fullest support of the Saudi, Egyptian, and U.S. governments. And Ali Muhammad, who answered bin Laden's call to Shalabi and who remained in the U.S. Army Reserves until August of 1994, was clearly an important trainer in that project in Egypt, in Afghanistan, and finally in America. A privileged account of Muhammad's career by Peter Bergen in Holy Wars Incorporated claims, quote, Ali Muhammad was an indispensable player in Al-Qaeda. At some point in the early 80s, he proffered his services as an informant to the CIA, the first of his several attempts to work for the U.S. government. The agency was in contact with him for a few weeks, but broke off relations after determining he was, quote, unreliable, unquote. That would turn out to be a masterful understatement, as Muhammad was already a member of Egypt's terrorist Jihad group. After being discharged from the Egyptian army in 1984, Muhammad took a job in the counterterrorism department of Egypt Air. The following year, he moved to the United States. Bergen's most serious omission here is that Muhammad, though he was on the State Department's visa watch list, had been admitted to the United States in 1984, quote, on a visa waiver program that was sponsored by the agency, the CIA itself, one designed to shield valuable assets or those who have performed valuable services for the country, unquote. This alone should be enough to question the CIA's cover story that it dismissed Muhammad as, quote, unreliable, unquote. Later, one of Muhammad's officers at Fort Bragg was also convinced that Muhammad was, quote, sponsored, unquote, by a U.S. intelligence service, quote, I assumed the CIA, unquote. In addition, Bergen omits that before Muhammad's brief stint as a formal CIA agent, he had been selected out of the Egyptian army in 1981 for leadership training at Fort Bragg, an important point to which we shall return later. In the next section, the FBI's cover-up of Ali Muhammad's connection to the Kahane murder. The CIA may have wanted to think that the Al-Qaeda training was only for Afghanistan, but the blind Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman, the mentor of the center, whom the CIA brought to America in 1990, was preaching for the killing of Jews and also for the destruction of the West. His preachings guided Muhammad's Maktab trainees as a first step in November of 1990. Three of those trainees conspired to kill Meir Kahane, the founder of the Jewish Defense League in New York City. Kahane was then shot in Manhattan in November of 1990. His actual killer, El Said Nosseir, was detained by accident almost immediately, and by luck, the police soon found his two co-conspirators, Mahmoud Abulima and Mohammed Salome, quote, waiting at Nosseir's house. Also at the house, according to John Miller, formerly of the FBI, quote, were training manuals from the Army Special Warfare School at Fort Bragg, where Ali Muhammad at the time was a training officer. There were copies of teletypes that had been routed to the Secretary of the Army and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, unquote. And the Pentagon bio, with yet another gentle dig at the FBI, identifies the documents at Muhammad's, quote, in the search of Nosseir's home, the police found U.S. Army training manuals, videotaped talks that Muhammad delivered at the JFK Special Warfare Center at Fort Bragg, operational plans for joint coalition exercises conducted in Egypt, and other materials marked classified or top secret. These documents belong to Mohammed, who often stayed in New Jersey with Nasser. The documents did not surface during Nasser's 1991 trial for the Kahane murder. It is not known if the FBI investigated Mohammed in connection with these documents. Yet only hours after the 1990 killing, Joseph Borelli, B-O-R-E-L-L-I, the chief of the New York Police Department detectives, pronounced Nasser, quote, a lone, deranged gunman, unquote. A lone nut. A more extended account of his remarks in the New York Times actually alluded to Mohammed, though not by name, and minimized the significance of the links to terrorism in a detailed account of the Nasser home cache. Quote, the files contain articles about firearms and explosives, apparently culled from magazines like Soldier of Fortune, appealing to would-be mercenaries. But the police said the handwritten papers, translated by an Arabic-speaking officer, appeared to be minor correspondence and did not mention terrorism or outline any plan to kill the militant Jewish leader who had called for the removal of all Arabs from Israel. Quote, there was nothing at Nasser's house that would stir your imagination, Chief Borelli said. A joint anti-terrorist task force of New York City Police and the Federal Bureau of Investigation has been set up to look into any possible international links to the slaying, the official said, but so far has not turned up anything. Quote, nothing has transpired that changes our opinion that he acted alone, unquote, Chief Borelli told a news conference yesterday afternoon. And again, some of the documents, according to John Miller of the FBI, training manuals from the Army Special Warfare School at Fort Bragg, where Ali Mohammed at the time was a training officer, there were copies of teletypes that had been routed to the Secretary of the Army and the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Interesting. And continuing, I'm skipping down later. Later, an FBI spokesman said the FBI also believed, quote, that Mr. Nasser had acted alone in shooting Rabbi Kahane. Quote, the bottom line is that we can't connect anyone else to the Kahane shooting, unquote, an FBI agent said. Blaming the New York County District Attorney Robert Morgenthau, the FBI later claimed that the evidence retrieved from Nasser's home was not processed for 2 or 3 years. But Robert Friedman suggests that the FBI were not just lying to the public, but also to New York County District Attorney Robert Morgenthau, who had just helped expose and bring down the CIA-favored Muslim bank BCCI, a Saudi-sponsored ally of the Safari Club. By the way, the Safari Club was an international intelligence consortium that was put together to circumvent temporary and relatively limited restrictions on the American CIA. We've spoken about that in our discussions of book by Joe Trento, The Prelude to 9-1-1. I'll put links in the written description for this broadcast. Continuing. According to other sources familiar with the case, the FBI told District Attorney Robert M. Morgenthau that Nasser was a lone gunman, not part of a broader conspiracy. The prosecution took this position at trial and lost, only convicting Nasser of gun charges. Morgenthau speculated that the CIA may have encouraged the FBI not to pursue any other leads, these sources say. Quote, the FBI lied to me, Morgenthau has told colleagues. They're supposed to untangle terrorist connections, and they can't be trusted to do the job, unquote. Using evidence from the Mercer trial transcript, Peter Lance confirms the tension between Morgenthau's office, which wanted to pursue Mercer's international terrorist connections, and the FBI, which insisted on trying Mercer alone. By the way, the federal prosecutor in the BCCI case was none other than Robert Mueller, who was head of the FBI at this point in time, in a program. I believe it was For the Record 310 off the top of my head. I'll put the link in the description. Done in July of 2001, I specifically opined that Robert Mueller had been selected to head the FBI because he would deflect any inquiries that might be made into the profound links between the milieu of then U.S. President George W. Bush and the aforementioned BCCI, which was involved in drug smuggling and terrorism and with strong connections to U.S., Saudi, and British intelligence. And the next section, and we will be continuing with this discussion, certainly in our next program, perhaps our next two. This is called The FBI's Protection of Ali Mohammed in the 1993 World Trade Center Bombing. In thus limiting the case, the police and the FBI were in effect protecting not just Ali Mohammed, but also Mosir's two Arab co-conspirators, Mahmoud Abu-Lima and Mohammed Salome, in the murder of a U.S. citizen. The two were thus left free to kill again on February 26, 1993, 1 month after the FBI secured Mohammed's release in Vancouver. That's where Mohammed, that's what the RCMP did. It wasn't Montreal, it was Vancouver. Continuing. Both Abu-Lima and Salome were ultimately convicted in connection with the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, along with another Mohammed trainee, Nidal Ayad. But again, Abu-Lima, Salome, and Ali Mohammed, not charged in connection with the assassination of Meir Kahane. To quote the Pentagon biography yet again, quote, in February of 1993, the terrorist cell that Mohammed had trained exploded a truck bomb under the World Trade Center that killed six and injured about 1,000 persons. The perpetrators of this bombing included people Mohammed had trained, and Mohammed had been in close contact with the cell during the period leading up to the bombing, i.e. January of 1993, the month of Mohammed's detention and release in Vancouver. Mohammed's name appeared on a list of 118 potential unindicted co-conspirators that was prepared by federal prosecutors. And again, in the prosecution of Ramzi Youssef, they only mentioned the name of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed once, and they had on Youssef's laptop the complete layout for the attack that was eventually executed on September 11th, and which led to the 20-year war in Afghanistan. Peter Dale Scott goes on. Ali Mohammed was again listed as one of 172 unindicted co-conspirators in the follow-up Landmarks case, which convicted Sheikh Rahman and others of plotting to blow up the United Nations, the Lincoln and Holland Tunnels, and the George Washington Bridge. The two cases were closely related, as much of the evidence for the Landmarks case came from an informant, Imad Salem, whom the FBI had first planted among the World Trade Center plotters. And we will continue with this discussion in our next program, perhaps two programs. This, however, concludes For the Record program 1181, Terror, the Afghanistan War, and the American Deep State, Part 1, being recorded on April 15th of the year 2021. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.